Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Jennings v. Burgess.
May it please the court, Ms. Cheryl E. Diaz will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent Dr. Jerry D. Jennings, who is one of many defendants in the medical malpractice case below. We come before this court today with a case that offers the court a wonderful opportunity to provide some much-needed clarity in the law in Texas governing medical malpractice actions. Specifically, we're asking the court to clarify when the open court's defense applies in a medical malpractice action and what a defendant's burden is when moving for summary judgment on limitations grounds in a medical malpractice action. The sole claim against my client below was a claim for negligent referral. It was and is undisputed that that referral occurred on March 3, 1989. It is likewise undisputed that the plaintiff did not file this lawsuit until May 13, 1993, more than 4 years after the negligent referral. Dr. Jennings accordingly moved for summary judgment in the trial court.
What are the elements of negligent referral?
I believe they're the same elements as a negligent claim, but simply that the referral was below the standard of care. In other words, the allegation in this case being that the doctor should have referred to a specialist versus a general practitioner and that the failure to do so was below the standard of care.
Are there cases that have so held?
I don't believe the cases discuss the elements separately from just general negligence elements, Your Honor.
If there was a referral to a specialist who then was negligent, is that imputed to the referring doctor?
No, Your Honor. The DeSiga case speaks directly to that, which is in our brief. And that court states that the date of the tort is the date of the referral. In other words, it's the mere fact of referral that gives rise to the negligence claim. There's no imputed liability based upon the negligence of the subsequent physician.
Well, not as to time, though, but as to liability. Is the answer the same?
I believe the answer is the same, and there were certainly no allegations to that effect in this case.
So if Dr. A refers a patient to Dr. B, and the next day Dr. B commits malpractice, that's not Dr. A's liability?
I think it's the sole fact of whether or not the referral was proven, which governs the liability of the referring doctor.
But if Dr. B was negligent, one might argue that Dr. A shouldn't have referred him to him.
One might argue that, Your Honor, but it wasn't argued in this case. The sole claim was the referral on that date.
But with respect to liability, the two might be tied together.
Perhaps. In this case, the trial court granted summary judgment on limitations grounds. The Court of Appeals in Dallas reviewed the case, and they agreed that the claim was barred by the 2-year statute of limitations. But in an opinion that bespeaks confusion to me, the court went on to hold that this was an open court case, that open court that the claim was application of the statute was unconstitutional as applied in this case, and then went on to hold.
But didn't you concede for purposes of your summary judgment that the plaintiff did not discover the problem until after the limitations had run?
Your Honor, we never conceded that this was an open court case. We solely said if the court was going to apply an open court analysis, we would concede the date of discovery for purposes of the motion.
Then why would open courts not apply?
Your Honor, the open court case that this court addressed in Weiner v. Lawson earlier this year is a narrow-made exception, and it's to apply in cases only where the injury is inherently impossible or exceedingly difficult to discover. We take the position as outlined in our briefs that that's not so in this case. The unique facts of this case were that the diagnosis was for a lesion which the plaintiff had previously been diagnosed with in another area of her body, and she'd been previously treated by a specialist. She testified in this case that at the time that my client made the diagnosis, she wanted to be treated by a specialist. She told him to refer her to a specialist, and he referred her to a general practitioner. We take the position that based upon those facts, she had knowledge of sufficient facts to trigger inquiry, to exercise due diligence, and to bring her suit within 2 years. We take the position that that brings this case outside of the open court's provision, which should be a very limited application in light of the legislature's enactment of Section 10.01.
What is the specific act of negligence alleged?
The specific act is the referral on March 3, 1989 by my client to a general practitioner.
And what is alleged to be negligent about the referral?
That it was to a general practitioner as opposed to a specialist.
And there are no other issues or allegations?
No other allegations, no attempt to impute liability based upon the second.
And I think I've read this in your brief that in the petition, the open court's doctrine was not pled by the plaintiff.
That's correct. In fact, the plaintiffs amended their pleadings after we filed our motion for summary judgment, and they still did not raise open court. That issue first came to light in their response. When we filed our reply, we filed a written objection.
But that's all right, isn't it? We've already held that. That you don't have to plead them in your opening pleading. You can raise them in a response.
That's correct. We believe that once the movement in a limitations case establishes conclusively, as we did, that the statute barred the claim, the burden then shifts to the non-movement to raise whatever arguments it wishes to suspend or toll limitations, which they did in their reply. The burden then shifts back to us to negate those issues. We did that, Your Honor. In the very same proof that we filed at the time we filed our motion for summary judgment, we established the following facts. Number one, based upon the concessions of the plaintiff, they claimed their date in which they knew they had a cause of action was May 7, 1991, which was the date that they were finally seen by a specialist. We established that a month later, in June 1991, Mrs. Burgess intended to see my client. We established that on July 15, 1991, she had retained counsel for that purpose. She was writing letters to her subsequent treaters asking them to send her medical records to her attorney because she intended to sue. There was no controverting proof. The plaintiff never did, at this date, I still don't know why, offer any proof to provide a justification for that delay. They waited more than 2 years after the date they concede they discovered this claim to file suit in this case. And we believe that the proof we offered at the time we filed our motion and that we argued to the court after we filed our reply sufficiently joined issue, sufficiently brought the issue before the court, and sufficiently established that as a matter of law they had failed to file suit within a reasonable time.
What would be a reasonable time under the facts of this case?
I don't know that the court or that I could articulate what constitutes a reasonable time, but I do think that the fact that the statute of limitations in malpractice cases is 2 years gives us a benchmark. And I think the fact that in this case, they contend that they discovered their claim on May 7, 91 and didn't file suit until May 13, 1993 says that as a matter of law, that's more than 2 years and that's not
if we're trying to give other courts guidelines on what is and what is not a reasonable time, what kind of guidelines would you suggest would be appropriate in determining what's a reasonable time? You're saying something short of 2 years.
Right, and I find that a difficult question to answer. I think it's going to have to be a fact-specific inquiry. But in all the cases I've read where there have been benchmark time periods held to be not reasonable as a matter of law, what the courts are focusing on is the due diligence on the part of the plaintiff. Did they have enough time to get a lawyer and to investigate and to file suit? And that's what the court needs to look at.
Is it a fact issue sometimes?
I think it can be a fact issue.
So it's kind of like the discovery rule or maybe the due diligence and service of citation after the expiration of...
Yeah, I get nervous saying the word fact issue, but I do think it can be a fact issue in certain circumstances. I think if the plaintiff in this case had come forward with proof saying, well, we delayed because of X, Y, and Z, the court could find that there was a fact issue there and find that it wouldn't decide as a matter of law. But there's some great discussion in some of the cases that we cite in our brief. Those cases are analogous to this case where there is no proof to rebut what the defendant says as far as what the plaintiffs knew by their own concessions and what the fact they had an attorney and could have filed suit. And in a case such as this, I think that it is as a matter of law, and the court can decide.
But does it make any difference in this case that the conceded date of discovery is after the statute is run completely?
No, Your Honor. There are cases, we cite the Legesse case in our brief. That's one of the few cases I'm aware of where it's analogous to our case. The date of discovery falls outside of the statute. But that court employed...
Well, but the two, the Nelson versus Christian and the other case, both fact situations are the same as this. But this court, for whatever reason, didn't decide that issue in either of those cases.
In our position, Your Honor, is that shouldn't make a difference. What the open court provision says, it doesn't address whether you really discover your cause of action within or without the statute. It says, does the plaintiff have a reasonable time to investigate their claim and bring suit? And our position is whether they discover their claim within the statute or without, in this case, they had a reasonable time and they failed to file suit within a reasonable time. The analysis should
but
be noted.
But you have a stronger argument if you find out about it before the 2 years is run to say, well, if you don't file it within the 2 years, you missed the vote. But here they had no opportunity, at least for the summary judgment purpose.
Right, but if the court takes the position that the analysis is different based upon the date of discovery, what we're doing is encouraging plaintiffs to lay low, to not exercise diligence, and not discover their cause of action until after the 2 years has run, because then what we'll be doing is reinstating the discovery rule, which the legislature intended to abolish in 10.01. Every plaintiff will then think they have a 2 full years after discovering their cause, their claim, so long as they discover outside of the 2 years. Don't believe they have that full period within which to bring suit. We don't believe that's what the legislature intended, and
but you're not going to get those factual circumstances in every case. In this case, because of the concession, changes the factual situation, because apparently they agreed that March 3rd, 89 is the date the statute began to run.
Correct.
But are you arguing that this can apply in every case then?
Yes, we believe that irrespective of the date of discovery, if the court decides this is an open court case, if the court decides that the statute has cut off the plaintiff's right to sue, the sole inquiry that should be that the plaintiff have a reasonable time to bring its claim. And in a case like this, where the statute has already run, the analysis is, did they bring suit within a reasonable time? And we're saying in this case, as a matter of law, by waiting more than 2 years, they did not.
Okay, Ms. Diaz, this is a problem with, seems to me, a summary judgment practice, because what ordinarily would be a burden of the plaintiff switches to the defendant and brings a summary judgment. You have demonstrated certain days that are undisputed as to when a decision to sue and gathering information. And you, seems to me, Dr. Jennings is relying on us to provide the inference, since these certain dates were known, that waiting 2 years was not reasonable without a demonstration of some facts showing how it's that a reasonable person, I'm a reasonable person, had I known this, I would have filed it before then. Aren't we in a kind of a difficult position just because there's some undisputed facts about when she knew to make the jump with the burden on the defendant on something that the plaintiff ought to have a burden on? To show that under no circumstances could this not have been reasonable?
Your Honor, this gets back to the point I think that Justice Cornell was raising. I think there are circumstances where this could become a fact issue and the court could say we're not going to decide whether this is reasonable or not as a matter of law. But the open courts provision has already injected so much uncertainty into what the legislature intended to be certainty in medical malpractice actions that I think we need to be careful, and I think the court does need to draw a line. The lower courts have done so. We've cited multiple cases in our brief where they said, based upon the facts of this case, yes, this was not reasonable as a matter of law. And I think this case is particularly unique because what we have here is a conceded date of discovery, which occurs more than 2 years before. If you use the 2-year statute of limitations as a benchmark, I think the court could be quite comfortable in saying that is not reasonable. I think,
to be very clear, you don't concede that open courts applies.
That's correct.
Your first position is that the statute began to run on the day of referral and therefore bars this action.
That's correct.
Only if open courts applies do you say that the date of discovery was the date claimed by the plaintiff.
That is correct. Last thing I'd like to mention before my time runs out is I'd like the court to focus on justice and policy and what the end result of this case will be if the Dallas Court of Appeals is correct. What they've essentially said is, well, Dr. Jennings, now you've got to go back to the trial court. You've got to file the exact motion for summary judgment. You have to use the magic words open courts, even though your proof all went to the issue of open courts in reasonable time, and even though you briefed that in your reply. And we're going to have to hear the same arguments and make the same decision. I think what the Court of Appeals has done is really shift improperly the summary judgment burden, place an impossible and onerous burden on a defendant in a malpractice case, which is contrary to the established law of the state. And I think this court has a wonderful opportunity, should it reach that issue in this case, to clarify just what a defendant has to do. There is a new Texas Court of Appeals case, I'll point out to the court, that didn't make it into our brief. It was decided on November 1995, Novel versus Spared. And that case is remarkably similar to this one, where an appellant in that case, he was challenging a summary judgment on limitations grounds, had never raised open court until they filed their response to the motion for summary judgment. In the reply, the doctor went back and rebutted that based upon the proof in the record. And the court states that those allegations raised in the reply by the plaintiff were just mere arguments against applications of the statute of limitations, and that the defendant in that case has appropriately met its burden in moving to summary judgment and responding to those arguments in his reply.
What's the cite on that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What's the citation on that case?
I just have a Westlaw cite, 1995 Westlaw 644083.
Which court was it out of?
That is the El Paso Court of Appeals.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Martha C. Bryant will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, thank you very much for your indulgence this morning. I believe that this is not necessarily a medical malpractice argument. This is a summary judgment argument. The court should center today on pleading and proof required in motions for summary judgment pursuant to Rule 166A of the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure. Under McConnell versus Southside and other cases that focus on what is necessary in moving forward for summary judgment, it has been clear that the motion for summary judgment shall state specific grounds therefore. In the petitioner's motion for summary judgment, the only ground therefore was that the statute of limitations had run. That was the only ground presented to the court. Even in their reply, that was still the ground they presented to the court. Therefore, the issue was not preserved for the Court of Appeals in Dallas to even hear as to whether or not open court had whether or not a reasonable time had run if open court applied. Once the Dallas Court of Appeals determined that the open court provision applied, there was no basis for that court to move any further.
Just so we're absolutely clear about the procedural history here, you did not, or your client did not plead open court in the petition, in any petition, is that correct?
That's correct.
It was first raised in response to the motion for summary judgment.
That's correct.
Was the issue of open courts and a reasonable time to bring suit thereafter joined in the brief at the trial court level?
For purposes of a defense to the motion for summary judgment, yes.
Did the defendant brief the question of open courts and reasonable time to bring suit in their pleadings, in the summary judgment pleadings before the trial court?
The defendant made a limited argument with regard to open courts in their reply to our response to their motion for summary judgment.
And in that reply, did they discuss or brief the question of reasonable time if open courts apply?
Yes. It was a very limited brief discussion, but yes, they did. However, briefs are not the same as the motion for summary judgment itself.
Does it make any difference if they call this pleading their reply to plaintiff's response to motion for summary judgment instead of calling it a reply brief? Are we going to be that technical?
I do not believe it does, because if you look at the document, it is in essence a brief. It is not.
But they say on page 7, even if open courts is applied to this case, plaintiffs fail to bring suit within a reasonable time after purportedly discovering their cause of action. You don't think that squarely raises the issue of reasonable time? And puts it, gives you notice of what they're talking about?
No, I don't. Because it is not in the motion for summary judgment, which is
what... Well, what about Stiles versus RTC? It says, follows up McConnell, and says, motion, response, and reply. If they're raised there, that's enough. How do you get around Stiles?
I believe that is essentially a reply brief and not a...
So your argument then is that if we characterize it as a brief, what they say is not valid as a response or reply. If we characterize it as a reply, it's good. Is that right?
Yes, I do. I agree with that.
So then the pleading practice is going to be hyper-technical in your view.
I think that's the essence of motions for summary judgment. It's the reason that you have a motion for summary judgment as opposed to a brief motion for summary judgment. I think, yes, that it is a technical form of practice. It is a very technical form of practice.
In case we get to the merits.
Yes, sir.
Why shouldn't the cause of action, limitations on this cause of action begin to run at the day of referral?
Your Honor, and I disagree with my opposing counsel on the issue of when limitations did begin to run, and we in our brief in the Court of Appeals did bring forward an alternative theory that the statute of limitations should begin to run because we had a continuing course of treatment by the doctor to whom Mrs. Burgess was referred, Dr. Manning.
But I take it it's your position that the referral does not become negligent until the referred doctor makes a mistake.
Exactly.
Why isn't the referral negligent in the first instance? In other words, why isn't it your position that the patient should not have been referred to a general practitioner no matter what?
Well, had that general practitioner
done a good job,
lived up to the standard of care for a physician treating the type of ailment my client had, a basal cell carcinoma, then there was no malpractice. There was no negligent referral. There was no malpractice in referring her to that physician.
This might mean that limitations would be a long period on negligent referrals.
It could be.
Could be years and years.
That is a concern. However, when a doctor refers a patient to another doctor and the patient relies on that referral, as my client did, and yes, I know my client, opposing counsel has argued that my client had other basal cell carcinomas that she knew how they'd been treated in the past. But nonetheless, when she went to her doctor and said, I think this is what I have, I would like to be referred to a specialist. If you look at the transcript, the reason she asked to be referred to a specialist is because this one was on the tip of her nose and she wanted to go to someone who would not leave a scar on the tip of her nose. Not because she wanted to go to a doctor who knew how to treat the basal cell carcinoma. When he referred her to a doctor to treat that, she relied upon that referral. And
what specifically did Dr. Jennings do that you say was negligent? Very specifically, what do you say Dr. Jennings did that was negligent?
Dr. Jennings referred her to a doctor who failed to treat the basal cell carcinoma in a manner which lived up to the standard of care that he should have treated.
How is Dr. Jennings in negligence? He referred. Now, what made him negligent in making the referral? You're not saying he's vicariously liable for the other doctor's treatment.
I'll tell you what I think, but there's no.
What did you allege? What's in the record?
Well, I'm afraid a lot of this may not be in the record. Is what my problem is. Our allegations were that this is a case where there were not many defendants. There were three defendants. The three original defendants were Dr. Manning, who did the treatment, Cigna Healthcare, who was the health insurance company for my client, and Dr. Jennings, doctor who referred. Dr. Jennings and Dr. Manning were a part of a group of practice who had a contract with Cigna Healthcare and HMO.
The HMO was sued as well?
Yes. Under that contract, then there was a requirement that the doctors meet with regard to referrals for specialists. At this meeting, we allege that where my client's request for a referral to a specialist was discussed, Dr. Manning said that he felt like he could handle the situation and no specialist referral was required in the situation where something to keep medical costs down.
What did Dr. Jennings do that you say was negligent, other than the referral to a GP? Anything?
Well, it's not necessarily a referral to a GP, because had the general practitioner treated her
did he have any reason to know that Dr. Manning would not treat her properly?
I believe he should have made an inquiry. It is our understanding that Dr. Manning said, I can handle this, and he said, okay. And he didn't say, how are you going to treat it? What are you going to do? Or will it leave a scar because the patient's requested that it not leave a scar? None of those questions were asked. And I believe that a doctor has a duty, just like a lawyer does when a lawyer refers a case to another attorney.
To guarantee results.
I'm sorry?
To guarantee results?
No. To see that the attorney or the doctor to whom it is referred understands the need of the patient and has the ability and the qualifications to treat the patient at a certain level.
Is there any allegation that you made in this case that Dr. Manning didn't have the qualifications or the ability and that Dr. Jennings knew that on the day of referral?
There are allegations that Dr. Manning did not appropriately treat the vital signs.
No, that's not my question. That he didn't have the ability or the qualifications and that Dr. Jennings knew that on the day of referral. Is there any allegation that you made?
There are no allegations that Dr. Jennings knew it on the day of referral. I don't think knowing is enough. I think that if he didn't know, then he should have made an inquiry.
And did you allege that Dr. Manning did not have the qualifications or the ability to properly treat?
Yes, that he was a general practitioner, was not skilled in treating basal cell carcinoma, and did not have the knowledge needed to treat my client.
Your position is that the decision to refer was based on something other than medical decision?
Yes.
That's your issue?
Yes.
So you're saying Dr. James' liability is because the decision was based on a reason that was not a medical professional reason.
We believe that was one of his reasons. Whether that was the sole reason or not, we don't know at this point. We believe that was one of his reasons, and that given that reason, he should have made an inquiry into whether or not Dr. Manning had the ability to treat my client.
If open courts does apply,
yes.
Why aren't you limited to a reasonable period after the date of discovery?
If open courts does apply, we may be limited to a reasonable period after the date of discovery. However,
now why is it 2 years as a matter of law not reasonable?
I don't believe that. However, I don't believe that was properly preserved for appeal. To go further, we filed our lawsuit. My client was referred to another physician in early May of 1991. I believe she wasn't actually seen by the other physician until later in the date of May, and I don't have those dates right in front of me right now, but I think if you go back and look at the transcripts, the dates aren't quite as clear as Ms. Diaz would present to you. Given those dates, I think we did file our lawsuit within 2 years. Further, and I believe that 2 years is probably reasonable. 2 years is what the statute of limitations is. 2 years plus 75 days.
2 years is probably what?
Would be reasonable. 2 years plus 75 days is what the statute of limitations is.
What about all the cases that hold anywhere from 21 months down to 7 months is an unreasonable time as a matter of law?
I also believe that this
is your argument similar to that was made in the Wiener case you ought to have 2 years following when you find out about it or you reach majority. Just the regular statute should apply.
I believe that this is a fact-driven issue, and that each case must probably stand and fall upon its own. I do not believe that saying 6 months following discovery or 3 months following discovery or 2 years following discovery if the court is going to continue with a reasonable standard, that this is going to be a fact-driven question.
Assuming that we do reach that issue in your case, what facts did you present that would present a fact question on 2 years as a reasonable time?
We did not present specific facts on reasonable time because we did not believe that the issue was properly before. We did not believe the issue was properly brought before the trial court for purposes of the motion.
You don't argue that it should be more than 2 years and 75 days?
No.
So there is some time that is kind of, as a matter of law, reasonable or unreasonable?
I say that today, given these facts and this situation. I can't say that given some different facts, I wouldn't reach a different conclusion.
Short of 2 years and 75 days, can the limitations ever run as a matter of law, or is this always going to be an issue for the fact finder? Inherent in any open court suit, you have to go to trial, and you may lose it after it's all done on a procedural ground.
I'm sure there is probably there is and should be a cutoff on what the reasonableness is. I hesitate to bar some other plaintiff's cause of action by giving this court my take, given my facts, on what that time should be. There are a myriad of facts out there that are going to come before courts all over the state. And I'm afraid that I really cannot answer the question as to what any other plaintiff's particular situation should be and how that should be applied as to open courts and the reasonableness.
It's rather inefficient for us to try to take an appeal in every case, as opposed to trying to set down some general guidelines.
I understand. I guess given that, then the 2 years and 75 days is probably the most logical for the court to set, since that is.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
I would like to just briefly respond to a couple of points my opposing counsel just raised. First of all, I would urge the court to please, to the extent there's any question about what the allegations were in this case, please refer to the record and look at the pleadings. I think we're getting far afield of what was ever alleged against Dr. Jennings in this case. The claim always has been a claim that he was negligent in referring this lady to a general practitioner as opposed to a specialist. We've always said that in our arguments. We've always said that in our briefs. They never stated to the contrary or pointed to anywhere in the record where the allegations were any different. With regard to when the cause of action or with regard to when the statute of limitations began to run on the negligent referral claim, the DeSiga case speaks precisely to this, and it says it's the date of referral. There is no other law in Texas that supports any other theory that there is some type of continuing or reviving trigger date for the statute. So for our purposes, we maintain...
Could there be a negligent referral with no harm, then? I refer my patient to a doctor who's grossly unqualified. Anybody knew or should have known that, but he just lucked out, or
and
she, and does a good job on this one occasion. Is there, if limitations started running, is there harm?
There may be no harm. There may be a claim, and there may be simply no damage to the claim, but there may be a claim of negligence with regard to the referral.
But you may have statute of limitations expire before there ever has been any harm, where there's been a legal wrong.
And in that case, that may become an open court case where some different type of scenario applies based upon the facts of that case. Our position is based upon the facts of this case. Negligent referral occurred based on their allegations on that date. The statute began to run because they had sufficient facts putting them on notice to make inquiry and to exercise diligence.
Let me ask you, Ms. Diaz, the plaintiffs are arguing that the summary judgment filed by Dr. Jennings that asserted that the statute of limitations run was not sufficient to rate, to permit the argument that the open court provision did not help here. And do you agree that open court is something that has to be raised separately from a general allegation that statute of limitations is run?
Is your question whether I believe it has to be raised in the motion for summary judgment?
I'm asking, do you agree that if the defendant files a motion for summary judgment based on the running of statute of limitations, that is not sufficient to encompass an argument on the issue of whether or not the open course changed the outcome?
No, I vehemently disagree with that. I think had they pled it in this case, our argument might be a little bit different, but I think in a case like this one where it's not pled and the defendant moves generally for summary judgment on limitations, and it meets his burden, which is to establish conclusively that the statute bars the claim, the burden shifts to them to raise issues of avoidance, which in this case is open court. Then the burden shifts back to us to negate it. And so long as we can do that, and so long as we have proof in the record, I believe that's sufficient. The DeSiga case says that. This new El Paso Court of Appeals that I've cited to the court says that. And any other result is just an outrageous burden on the defendant. I do also want to mention that had they had a problem with us arguing open court to reasonable time in their reply, they had a duty to make that known to the trial court. We take the position they should have objected or raised that then. They've never raised this issue. The Dallas Court of Appeals was the first place where this argument arose that the issue was not properly joined and raised.
Well, but the Dallas Court in its footnote indicated that its viewpoint was that your reply didn't go any further than your motion did. What's your response to the footnote?
With all due respect to the Dallas Court of Appeals, I don't understand footnote number 6, because as I read that footnote, it talks about our reply brief saying all kinds of things about failing to file suit in a reasonable time and applying open court. And I think what footnote 6 states is that we did, in fact, raise the issue of limitations and rebut the issue of open court in reasonable time in our pleadings before the trial court.
Well, right after you said even if open court is applied, plaintiffs fail to bring the suit within a reasonable time after purportedly discovering their cause of action, the next sentence says, plaintiffs' claims are therefore barred by the statute of limitations. What statute of limitations are you talking about there if open court applies? If you're trying to argue now that it's only a reasonable time that we should look at.
Well, I think that's...
Is it your argument the same as hers? We apply another two-year statute plus 75 days, as the Chief Justice suggested?
Certainly not. My argument
Isn't she timely?
No, my argument is that the concept of limitations bars these claims, but I don't believe open courts apply. But if you did apply it, they failed to file suit within a reasonable time, and therefore the claims are barred by the concept of limitations.
Not by latches. You didn't argue latches.
Didn't argue latches, sure.
So you don't get the benefit of that if it applies.
I guess not.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the second call, the court will take another brief recess.